Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Alina's very excited. I'm very excited as well, actually, because today History Hack becomes the official fangirls of the Hawker Typhoon. Alina, who's with us?
So we have Matt Bone with us, who is a historian and researcher specializing in Second World War aircraft, and he is here to talk to us about, guess what?
The Hawker Typhoon.
Exactly.
He's slightly obsessed, aren't you, Matt?
Little bit, I'm afraid, yes.
We're going to indulge you. We're going to indulge you today. Why? Why are you obsessed with this one aeroplane?
Well, it's a fantastic bit of kit that didn't quite work to start with, and I think that's what I like about it, because most of the things I start out with, I'm rubbish at. And
It's like the underdog, isn't it?
it is, and it's completely forgotten. Outside of D-Day and typhoons firing rockets, that's about it. But the overall story of the aircraft and the men who flew it, the women who delivered it, it's just extraordinary. And whenever we get to chat about it, it's you can just literally see people's eyes opening up and realizing that there's something more to Second World War aviation than Spitfires.
Let's not get carried away. Let's start. What is the Hawker Typhoon?
So the Hawker Typhoon is essentially the replacement aircraft for the Hawker Hurricane, designed by the same guy, Sidney Cam. And in the late 30s, when the Hurricane had just started entering service with the RAF, he sort of saw the need for taking the design a bit further. Essentially, the Hurricane is a biplane with the top wing taken off and a bigger engine put in it. And the Spitfire was sort of showing the way for what the new breed of fighters was going to be. And the development of the Hurricane wasn't going to make it much faster. So he started essentially doodling out what he thought the next stage would be before there was any requirement for it from the government. And he came up with this aircraft, which was a little bit bigger than the Hurricane, but weighed considerably more. It was big and it was strong, and that was sort of his obsession, was to make strong aircraft that could bring the pilot home. And the whole idea behind it was the 400 mile an hour barrier. So the Spitfire and the Hurricane could do about 350, 360 miles an hour. But the next big step in aircraft was this 400 mile an hour fighter. And Sidney Cam had been responsible for the RAF's first 200 mile an hour fighter and its first 300 mile an hour fighter. So he kind of wanted to do the 400 mile an hour one as well. So he developed this aircraft that had two different variants, but one of them became the Typhoon.
So you've got to tell us, when was it used and who used it?
So it first flew in 1940, and it was sort of flown all the way through to the end of the war. So just a little bit of background, you had two different variants of it. You had a Rolls-Royce powered version that had something called a Rolls-Royce Vulture in the front, which had a nasty tendency to always be on fire. And that aircraft was called the Tornado, and it was cancelled quite quickly. But the Typhoon, when it first flew in 1940, it performed as it was expected to. And then the Battle of Britain came along, and they decided that they needed to concentrate on the current frontline fighters. So it was quietly shelved until the outcome of the battle was clear. And then testing started in earnest from the end of 1940 through 1941, when it started to be delivered to the squadrons. And it just served with the RAF in northwestern Europe. So at its height, you had the majority of the squadrons were RAF. You had three Royal Canadian Aircraft squadrons, Royal Canadian Aircraft, Royal Canadian Air Force. I'm going to have my Canadian passport revoked for that one. And one New Zealand squadron as well. So it sort of built itself up through the war, but it was not without problems along the way, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute.
Yeah, why do they even need to go down this route if they've got the hurricane?
Well, the Hurricane is, like I said, it's quite an old idea. So it's basically tubes and fabric, and you can't really take it much faster without it literally ripping the fabric apart. So it's got lovely Irish linen over the rear fuselage, and it's 1920s and early 1930s thinking. And if you're going to go faster, you're going to go stronger, you're going to carry sort of more and bigger guns and bombs and rockets, you need something that's a little bit more beefy than the venerable old Hurricane, the irony was the Hurricane then served all the way through the war anyways. But the thinking was they needed to move forward and make this all metal stress skinned aircraft. Just because if they're going to put this massive Napier Sabre engine in the front of it with 2,000 horsepower, it needed to be able to cope with it. And they just thought that this massive engine with this big aircraft was going to be the fastest, all singing, all dancing, dog's bollocks of an aircraft that was out there.
Do you know what? Let's talk a bit technical things. Let's talk about the engine.
Okay.
Wasn't it just shit?
Tell it like it is, Alina. So
this is one of the two questions I get asked the most about it. Wasn't the Napier Sabre terrible and shouldn't it have been scrapped? Initially, yes. So just to explain what it is, it's massive. This thing weighs about a ton. It has 24 cylinders, 36 liters, 2,200 horsepower. And it comes from this company called Napier, which had made the engine for the first supermarine racing seaplanes. If you go to Brooklands, you can see their racing cars. They were a high performance outfit. But they sort of came up with this idea for this big H24 engine, which would produce incredible amounts of power. So if you think the Merlin that's in the Spitfire and the Hurricane in 1940s got about 1,100 horsepower. When the Sabre was built sort of 3 years before, it had twice as much power. So using the age-old maxim that more power is always better, they continued with this design. And it's different to a Merlin in that it's got something called sleeve valves, which are, to go really technical on you, is where the piston goes back and forth. There's a sleeve that turns sort of through about a quarter turn that opens and closes the valves. So it means there's sort of less moving parts within the engine, but it means you get a lot more power out of it. And its big problem was that it was British. And the manufacturing quality of the initial runs of engines was terrible. They were not cleaning the engines out, so there was all kinds of metal shavings in it, which would then block up the oil system and cause the engine to seize. The sleeve valves themselves are very precision engineered bits of kit. And when we get you ladies down to see the unit, you can have a look at some of these things. They need to be perfectly round. And if they drop out of true, they just jam up the engine and the engine stops. So they had big trouble with all these quality control issues. And it was just causing the engine to, without much warning, stop. And then you suddenly have a one-ton bit of weight at the wrong end of the airplane. At the time, most of the Typhoon operations were at quite low levels. So if the engine was going to stop, you didn't have any time to get out of it. So what happened was politics got involved. The Air Ministry and the Ministry of Supply basically told Napier that they had to sort this out. And if they didn't, they would. Napier didn't, because the engines were only lasting about 25 hours, which is nothing for an aircraft engine. So they brought in English Electric, which helped sort out the quality control issues. And then Bristol's, who made other aircraft engines, radial engines, but they had a lot of experience in sleeve valves. So they were brought in to help change the design of the sleeves. And sort of by late 1943, it was good. It was a very reliable, very robust engine. The problem was it was being tested in combat, the same problem with the aircraft itself. So there was a lot of engine failures early on, which sort of didn't help the aircraft's reputation much. And which I'm sure the other part that you're about to get to didn't help the reputation either.
Did the tail fall off?
Yes. Can we move
on? Well, that's not good, is it?
Okay, so we're gonna get.
Oh, gonna get technical. You said underdog, not shit show.
Shit engine, tail falling off. What else happens to this plane?
Let's let him put it in context for us, because we're always banging on about context. Go on, Matt. Well, shut up.
No, this trust me. These are the two things we Typhoon nuts face all the time. So yes, the tail did fall off, 27 times. if we're going to be precise, with the cost of about 25 pilots, which is pretty terrible. So what the problem is, you've got aircraft going regularly through the 400 and 500 mile an hour barrier in a dive. And that was a realm of physics that nobody really understood. And the Typhoon is basically a beefed up hurricane. So it's got a big, thick wing on it. And when you're going really fast at high altitude, the last thing you need is a big, thick wing. So that was causing the airflow over the wing to do lots of things that the guys at Hawkers didn't really understand. And the chief test pilot was a chap called Philip Lucas. And he, in an interview in the 70s, made the comment that they basically discovered aerial compressibility, but didn't realize that they'd made this discovery because they were too busy trying to fix it. And what was happening to the aircraft was, so basically whenever an aircraft flies, it doesn't stay the same shape that you think it is. It stretches and it twists and it moves around. And that's the way they're designed. And it has something called harmonic resonance, which means everything's shaking to a certain frequency. And the problem with the Typhoon was it was shaking at a frequency which was basically causing the tail to snap off in certain circumstances. And it wasn't a case of the aircraft was getting old and beaten up and it would just go even on a new aircraft. So what they were discovering was they didn't know what was happening. And they took, you know, typical belt and braces measures. They basically beefed up where the tail attaches to the fuselage. They put a big steel band around it to hold it on. And then they put 20 fish plates on it, which basically it was like an outward sign that it was strengthened. But their tails were still coming off. And, you know, Wing Commander Tim Elkington was a lovely chap who was a big supporter of the Typhoon project, said that he flew his aircraft to Oxford and they put these fish plates on it and he didn't think it did anything, but what it did give him was a fantastic night out in Oxford. So, you know, it took them quite a while to figure out what was going on. And then two things happened. An Irishman called Killy Kilpatrick on one of his first flights in a Typhoon dove his aircraft down to just under 500 miles an hour and the tail came off. And he managed to get out of the aircraft because he, for some reason, had been up at about 30,000 feet. So once he was picked up from the cow field that he landed in, he was whisked off to Langley, the Hawker headquarters, and to discuss what had happened. And that was the first indication they had of the sort of feedback that the pilot was getting before the tail came off. And then about a year later, another pilot reported some strange vibrations in his aircraft after a dive bombing attack. And they took that aircraft to Farnborough and shook it to pieces. And they realized that the aircraft was balanced wrong. So under the control column, you've got a big weight. And at the tail, you've got another weight. And that helps balance it out. They essentially doubled the two weights. And that cured the problem. But it unfortunately took, you know, 27 lost aircraft and quite a few pilots to figure that out. But all of this learning would then go into the next generation of aircraft that would come along, especially when they got into the jet age, that these sort of harmonics that would come through. Unfortunately, it would catch de Havilland out with metal fatigue in the Comet later as well.
Which I suppose answers what was going to be our next question, which is why did they bother carrying on if it was such a nightmare?
Well, the reason they carried on with it wasn't so much for the science, was because the aircraft is starting to prove itself as actually pretty good. You think, okay, so the engine stops and the tail falls off. That, you know, why would you want to get in that thing?
Yeah.
And its reputation when it was going to the squadrons wasn't great, but it had a couple of things with it. It, you know, it had four big 20 millimeter cannons on it that worked. And it was incredibly fast. And it was, most importantly, faster than the new German FW-190 at low level and could outturn it. So when the Germans showed up with the 190, which is a truly great little aircraft, it was better than a Spitfire. And they were doing these hit and run raids all along the south coast. And the only thing that could catch it was the Typhoon. So they put all the Typhoon squadrons on the south coast to sort of counter all these raids coming in. And it was starting to rack up, you know, noticeable amounts of kills. And then you've got some quite aggressive young pilots being put in charge of squadrons, and they're wanting to make names for themselves. One of them was named Roland B. Beaumont, who was in charge of 609 Squadron. And he had experience of flying night intruder flights over France. And he started doing the same thing with his Typhoons. And they had something seriously against trains, a pathological hatred that the official squadron history calls it, because they would fly over France and Belgium and Holland and do nothing but shoot up trains, which was great for the war effort, but it sort of made everybody wonder what experience these guys had had on a train, which made them so prevalent to go out and destroy as many of them as they could. But that was really it. It, you know, despite these faults, it was actually, you know, very useful for the problem that they had, which was this sort of FW-190 issue. And then, as we'll go on to chat about, you can suddenly start putting vast amounts of bombs and rockets underneath the wings, and you've got a very impressive ground attack aircraft.
Well, this brings us to the next question, funnily enough, which you mentioned earlier, which is Normandy. So how does Normandy fall into this whole narrative of the Hawker Typhoon?
So Normandy is really the Typhoon's moment. And it's taken, you know, as we've talked about, a lot of pain to get here. And through 1943, the RAF goes through a lot of changes. One of the main ones is the creation of the 2nd Tactical Air Force, which is whole purpose is to support the coming invasion. And at the tip of the spear of this is the Typhoon squadrons, because through 1943, they've started putting bombs under the wings. They started off with little 250-pounders. They went up to 500-pounders. And in the end, they were carrying two 1,000-pound bombs under the wings. And through 1943, they're attacking the V1 sites as they start to be built. They're attacking radar stations. And they start to realize that this actually, as this sort of tactical striking arm, is really useful. So more Typhoon squadrons start coming online. And in 1944, you start adding the 60-pound RP-3 rocket, which is what most of the newsreels then focus on. And you get the entry of the rocket-firing Typhoon, which is quite a fearsome, if slightly inaccurate, beast. So coming up to Normandy, the Typhoon squadrons are tasked with knocking out the radar stations, and they call it the radar war in the histories. And it's a very costly battle because they are attacking low-level, heavily defended targets. And there's quite a few Typhoons lost during this period. So squadrons are slightly under strength by the time we get to the 6th of June. And what you have then is 18 Typhoon squadrons, all based along the south coast, 9 of which will be used in sort of defense, and 9 of which will be used in attack. And the first aircraft over the beaches are actually the Canadian squadrons attacking the hard points just behind Sword, Gold, and Juno beaches. And they're flying in at low level with 1,000-pound bombs and dropping them on the pillboxes. And then through the rest of the day, you know, because the beaches are under naval cover, the Typhoons are actually released into armed reconnaissance, and they just go hunting. And they're shooting up German HQs. They're attacking troop movements, basically anything that's moving behind the lines that they're looking for and attacking it. And unfortunately, they prove the falsity of the myth of the Luftwaffe not showing up, because they get bounced quite a number of times by the Luftwaffe and lose about 6 aircraft to air-to-air action. But that's really this sort of moment where, in the public eye, the Typhoon starts becoming noticeable as this big beast, big noisy beast that fires these rockets. And the newsreels go mad for it. And you can look at the old Pathé footage of, you know, the RAF flying artillery and things like that. They look like they're doing incredible work. Post-war research shows that they didn't destroy as many tanks or trucks as was expected. Well, actually, many tanks with the rockets, because, you know, when you're dropping your rockets or your bombs, you see a big explosion and lots of smoke, you claim the tank you were aiming at. But it's very hard to hit a small, you know, a small target from an aircraft that's moving around at 500 miles an hour with something that's essentially a firework with 60 pounds of high explosive on the end. And it's sort of this sort of narrative that we have a lot of debate going on at the moment. And there's been some great academic work about how many tanks were actually destroyed by typhoons. But the thing you've got to remember is a tank is only as effective if it has a crew, it has fuel, and it has ammunition. And the typhoon's psychological effect would be that when they started to attack, experienced crews would know just to button down the hatches and wait for them to go away. But inexperienced crews would bail out. And that's where they would be getting caught with the shrapnel from the rockets and the bombs. And then once the rockets and the bombs were gone, the typhoons would go looking for German trucks. They'd go looking for the horse-drawn ammunition trains. And they would shoot those up with their cannon for fun. And that's where they were most effective, was taking out the tail, stopping movement, and causing wholesale slaughter behind the lines. It's for as great as these eight rockets firing off, and they look on film and things like that, they weren't terribly accurate because they're being shot from an aircraft that's being shot at with a very amped up pilot in it, trying very hard not to get hit while still hit something. And all of these different things make unguided weapons very inaccurate.
Tell me, there's got to be some sort of really positive ending for this, because, you know, obviously it started out really shitty with a shit engine and a tail falling off. Then it goes to Normandy and it seems to be quite successful. But does it end well?
Well, the reputation turns around. So from the troops on the ground loved the Typhoon. So the Canadians, when they would get in trouble, they had a saying that they would whistle for a tiffy, because they knew if they got on the radio, the Typhoons would show up very quickly and help them out. At the Battle of Mortain on the 7th of August, there was an American division caught on a hill, and the Typhoons with artillery support helped stop the German advance. And one 247 squadron pilot got shot down. And he was returned to his squadron by the Americans 2 days later in a state of alcohol poisoning, because they were so happy for the work that he did, they just kept plying him with Calvados and beer. So the story does turn around, and especially as you sort of move through the latter half of the war, and especially into 1945, the reputation of the aircraft is renewed. The problem is it's been replaced. All the problems that the Typhoon had went straight into the Hawker's drawing board, and the Typhoon Mark II came out, which was renamed the Tempest. And it was possibly the fastest piston engine aircraft of the Second World War. And it was everything that the Typhoon should have been. It worked at high altitude. It was great at low level. It was responsible for, I think, nearly half of all the V1s destroyed that were sent at London in the southeast. So with the Tempest there, and then the aircraft that came after it, the Fury, also on the drawing board, when the war ended, the Typhoon was no longer needed. So with wonderful lack of foresight, they were all scrapped. They were flown back to England and chopped up.
Well, this quite nicely leads on to the next bit, because you currently have a project on the go, which involves, obviously, the Hawker Typhoon. So can you tell us a bit about this project?
I would love to. So
go for it. Tell everyone.
My other hat, and this is going to become clear, is I'm the public relations manager for the Hawker Typhoon Preservation Group. And as the title suggests, we are trying to preserve a Hawker Typhoon. And our aircraft is we have the sort of rear fuselage of an aircraft called RB-396, which was shot down in Holland in 1945. And we are restoring her to flight because there is only one Typhoon left in the world, and that's in the RAF Museum. And no one has ever seen a Typhoon fly since about 1947. So our aim is to rebuild RB-396 with the Sabre engine, which we have, to flight as a living memorial for the Typhoon's crews. Air, ground, the men and women who built and worked them, because it's a fantastic forgotten story, and we believe they need this memorial, and there'll be nothing better than to see one of their aircraft flying again. Because, you know, 664 pilots were killed flying the Typhoon, and their graves are scattered all over Europe. Many are in Runnymede because they have no known grave. And there's one memorial to them at Neues Brückage. So our whole aim is to put that right and to show people just how incredible this aircraft was, and that it didn't always have an engine that stopped, and it didn't always have the tail falling off. And that these brave men who got into them and went to war in them, in the most dangerous of circumstances, where they're flying against walls of flak, you know, this is a tale that needs to be told, and we believe a flying Typhoon is going to do it.
What can people do if they want to get involved?
Well, they can visit our website, which is hawkertyphoon.com, and you can read all about the project on there. We have the RB-396 Supporters Club, which is the sort of the easiest way you can support, and that starts at about £25 a year. So we're a registered UK charity. So any of your donations, if you're a taxpayer, can get gift aid on it as well. And basically, through public support, we've started rebuilding this aircraft. And yeah, we'll get on to tell her story in a minute. But, you know, if people want to see something other than a Spitfire flying again or a Hurricane flying again, you know, we believe this Typhoon project is probably one of the most unique warbird projects that's going on in the world. And, you know, we're trying to make it as open as it can, so people who get involved can see as much and as we can show them. And, you know, we're sort of changing up the way we're working at the moment to go focusing on some slightly higher backers so that we can accelerate things. So if anyone out there has £5 million that wants to donate to a charity, please give me an email.
What can you say to make people fall in love with her? What do you know about her?
So 396 is essentially a completely ordinary Typhoon. She was built in late 1944. She was delivered on New Year's Eve 1944 to 174 Squadron in Holland at Vokel. And she, you know, she didn't fly at Dieppe. She didn't fly at Normandy on D-Day. So, you know, that kind of puts people off. But what she did do was she flew in support of Operation Varsity, which was the largest airborne operation in history. But the most important thing about her are the people that flew her. And that's why we're sort of so happy that the Dutch chemical company who bought the wreck decided to keep this piece of her, to turn her into a shower, believe it or not. And when that didn't happen, they gave it to a museum before it came to us with the proviso, we have to make her fly again. And you know, those people are the reason why this aircraft and all Typhoon stories are interesting. So we started at the beginning. Her test pilot was a chap called Lawrence Pinky Stark, because all RAF pilots need a decent nickname, and I think Pinky's one of the best. Apparently, he always had a rosy face, so that's why he got that. but he joined Beaumont 609 Squadron, which was this uber Typhoon squadron that was full of Belgians who did things like shooting up SIPO SD headquarters in Amsterdam, in Brussels, shooting up trains and basically being, you know, one of the most formidable like Typhoon outfits that there were. Pinky was shot down in July 1944, and he was helped by the resistance to escape and sent up to Gloucester's, where the Typhoons were built, to test fly these new aircraft as they're coming off the line. He flew RB twice and sent her on her merry way. And you know, Stark is fascinating because his career was almost exclusively on Typhoons during the later half. And he was a squadron leader. He later flew on the tragic raid that sunk the Cap Arcona, which I know you guys had the excellent podcast about it earlier in the year. And, you know, so through him, we have all these fascinating links. But then these links continue even more so when we get to her ATA pilot, who I think is the reason why I'm involved in the project, because her name was Anna Leska. She was a Pole, and she is, well, my hero, really. She flew for Polish Army High Command during the invasion of Poland. She flew little light aircraft delivering messages to the frontline units. And after they were overrun, her and a friend snuck onto an airfield at night and stole an aircraft. They didn't know how much fuel it had, but all they knew is they had to get south as quickly as they could. So at night, they took off with no lights and flew south and just kept flying until the fuel ran out. And luckily, they'd gotten to Romania by that point. And she escaped across Europe through to the south of France. And when she got to Paris, she rejoined with her Polish Air Force colleagues. And she was formally commissioned into the Polish Air Force and was one of only two women to be allowed to wear the Polish Air Force uniform. She was eventually joined the ATA in the UK. And then she ended up sort of delivering over 2,000 aircraft, which is remarkable. And she was a bit of a feisty character. I didn't tell you this yesterday, Alina, but she had a running feud with another ATA pilot, a Chilean pilot called Margot Dunhill, I think Dunhill her name was. And they famously had a mock dogfight over Hamble when the Chilean cut in front of her in a queue, and they were both told that if one of them didn't apologize to the other, they'd both be kicked out. So the Chilean apologized in front of the boss, and then when she walked out, she threatened to punch Anna's teeth in. And they never forgave each other. Even many years later at a reunion, they were still found in a corner shouting at each other. And you know, she's just amazing.
I love her. Really, really love her. When you told me the story about it yesterday, I was like, this woman is epic, and we need to commemorate her so much.
She's wonderful, but it's, you know, her family as well. And this is where I get to murder a Polish name. I'm sorry, because her brother was Kamerz Leski. Did I get that right? No, I didn't. I got the G in the middle. tell me how to say it, Alina.
Kazimierz.
Yes, that. So Anna's brother stayed in Poland, and he was a musketeer. His code name was Brandl, and he was one of the intelligence officers for the Home Army, and most likely worked with Krystyna Skarbek, who Claire Mulley wrote that fantastic biography, The Spy Who Loved, about. And it's sort of one degree of separation from this aircraft takes us to, you know, to the Warsaw Uprising. And it's these little tangible links that, you know, this story we can tell, that the people that touched this aircraft, you know, their families were sort of involved everywhere. That's just the delivery pilot. And you think, you know, we are so fortunate to have this link to Anna and her family that we try very hard to trumpet it. And we're also very fortunate that she had a very famous photograph taken of her by Lee Miller on her first assignment for Vogue, sat in a Spitfire. So we share that, and we're hoping to do something with the Lee Miller archive soon to sort of champion these incredible women.
Before the aircraft
gets handed over to a bunch of boys again.
I'm so excited about this, because it would just be so amazing to, well, help you bring her alive, literally. I mean, she was alive, but you know what I mean, historically alive.
And you know, for her, it was just another typhoon in her logbook. You know, the day she delivered it, she delivered a Spitfire and a Mosquito, I think. So it was, you know, it was just another day at the office for her. But for us, it's amazing that we're very fortunate that Anna delivered it, as we are with her other three pilots, of whom one is still alive. Because a regular pilot was a Canadian called Frank Johnson. He was a bit of a lad, and constantly got turned over for promotion because he kept telling his squadron leader exactly what he thought. So a true Canadian, really. And Frank flew her for most of her career. He painted his girlfriend's name on the nose, Sheila, which was sort of gold down one side. And then he was shot down in another aircraft and was very badly injured. His back was broken. And luckily he was saved by some Germans who took him to a farmhouse, where the German lady cared for him, cleaned his wounds, kept calling him Liebchen, and he was repatriated, where, having left his girlfriend 4 years before, while he was in hospital having his back rebroke, he called for a nurse, and in walked his girlfriend. And they then married when they got back to Canada, which was great.
That. Well, can you tell our listeners before we finish, can you tell our listeners the story about the pilot walking into the bar?
Yes. So the top scoring Hawker Typhoon ace is a chap called Johnny Baldwin. And his story is really quite amazing. His early days and his birth are shrouded in mystery. The official story says he was born in Bristol in 1918. The unofficial story was it was actually a year before on the Isle of Wight when his parents had a romance. And then they then doctored the paperwork to make him legitimate a bit later. But he flew Typhoons with 609 Squadron as well. And he was just the most incredible pilot. He would eventually go on to get 15 confirmed victories. But he was an interesting chap because he seems to have been quite shy as well. He walked into a bar in Belgium, I believe, with the squadron doctor. And he saw this woman across the bar and was smitten. And he turned to the doctor and he said, I don't know what to say to her. And the doctor looked at him and just said, "You're Johnny Baldwin. You're the most famous pilot around here. You walk up to her and say, 'Hi, I'm Johnny Baldwin.'" And that was his line, and it worked, and they married and they had a couple of kids. And you know, we're very fortunate to have his family as firm backers of the project as well. And you know, it'll be great to be able to fly the aircraft in his colors as well one day. Because he had a very sad fate. I didn't tell you this yesterday, Lynette, that he stayed on in the RAF and insisted on continuing flying. And when the Korean War broke out, he asked for a transfer to the U.S. Air Force to fly F-86 Sabres. And on his seventh mission, he disappeared over North Korea. And nobody knows what happened to him. The most likely event is he was killed, but unfortunately with famous pilots and unknown finishes, there's lots of conspiracy theories about him, which are all rubbish basically, but unfortunately we have to spend a lot of time debunking those, that he did not end up in a Russian interrogation camp as some of these crazy stories that people like spreading do. But he was he was only in his early 30s when he was killed, having survived. Yeah, nobody actually knows how many Typhoon missions he flew. His logbook says 150, but unofficially, because he didn't write down every time he flown, because he kept being told not to fly, it was more likely 200 plus, which is a remarkable run of luck, really, for more than anything else, because very few Typhoon pilots racked up those sorts of numbers.
Do you want to know something? I kind of wish you didn't tell me that, because I had this beautiful romance story in my mind of these two people getting married. And now I find out that he disappeared over North Korea. Was it North Korea you said?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I
feel wrong. It's unfortunately that, yeah, that ending is all too common.
It isn't in our fields, unfortunately. You want a nice, beautiful romance story for about 60 seconds, and then it all goes to shit, really.
Well, we do have one lovely story, which is one just before our aircraft was shot down. Frank had lent his aircraft to a little chap called Sidney Russell Smith, who, when you see pictures of him, he looks about 12. And his nickname was Boy. And he flew RB once, damaged it, which was why Frank wasn't flying it when it got shot down. But Sidney is still with us. He lives over in Suffolk. We realized that we had never actually made him a member of our supporters club. So just while lockdown was happening, we heard that he was having a little bit of a difficult time coping with not seeing family. So We did a video for him telling him about all the latest all the latest happenings on the rebuild of his Typhoon. And we made him an honorary lifetime member of the Supporters Club. And I was just recently sent a little video of him. They presented him with the pack and the badge that we sent to him in front of the other residents, the care home, and he got a big round of applause. We're really looking forward to going up and seeing him once the restrictions are such that we're able to visit. But we're in touch with his care home, and we've just sent him a print as well of that's one of our supporters had commissioned of the rebuilt aircraft flying over the museum at Duxford, and they very kindly donated one to us and another one to send to Sydney. So he should be getting that today, and we can't wait to see what he thinks of it.
I think that is such that I think we should finish on that really beautiful positive note, because that's really lovely. So listen, Matt, thank you so much for coming to join us, talking to us about the shitty engine and the shitty tail, but then we're having something a bit positive at how well the Hawker Typhoon performed in Normandy, to obviously that beautiful love story, and Analeshka, who for me, she blows my mind and she is just awesome. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, guys. This has been a lot of fun.
Join us tomorrow when Robin Osborne will be talking to us all about homosexual imagery in ancient art. Really fascinating chat. Don't miss that one.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.